My name is Solis, and I am a grateful recovering co-alcoholic. I am privileged to be a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of the Al-Anon Family Groups. And I want to thank, before I forget anything else, I want to thank the people who had anything to do with bringing me here, and certainly Tracy and Val for having me in their home, and everybody being so hospitable, and Ed and Don and everybody who's been so gracious this weekend. It's wonderful, and it's the best part of being able to travel and meet new people in recovery is making new friends, and I feel like I've done that this weekend, so it's already been a success. I'll tell you a little bit about how I got to Al-Anon and what it's like now, and the way that I like to do that is I'm a very visual person, and so I do much better with pictures, and so I brought some with me today so that you could follow along with my little Al-Anon story. And so I'm going to project the images right up here in this little space, and so you'll see what's going on, and I want to... I know the committee's going like, was there a projector? What were we supposed to? So now I'm just going to put them right up here, so you'll see them. And so we're gonna start off with what it was like. So this first slide is, if you'll see, or maybe some of you recognize, it's the Capitol Dome of California, Sacramento. That's where I'm from. Was born. Well, I'll just show you. You can see in height order, I'm the oldest of five in this Mexican-American, very Catholic family. My mother there with a beverage in her hand, she's the alcoholic that originally brought me to the doors of Al-Anon. Since I've gotten here, I've got a lot more alcoholics in my life, but she was the original reason that brought me into Al-Anon. And I'm just going to fast forward to high school. So here's me in high school. And I'll admit, full up, that I took advantage of Photoshop with that picture. I was not the head cheerleader in high school, but I really, really, really wanted to be. I had an intense desire to be liked at any cost, and I would have loved to have been that popular person that people just love to be around and hang out with. But that's not the truth. So let me show you the truth. Those are my feet sticking out that trash can. That's me being thrown into a locker, me running from an angry crowd. So that is the truth. The truth is that if I had a sash across me, it wouldn't have said homecoming queen. It would have said class fag. And I was the one back in the 80s who was picked on and made fun of. And so what I love about the program of Al-Anon is that I get to find people that I identify with and who have similar experiences. I don't want to convey to you in any way that I'm a victim of any kind, because what I've learned is that those experiences that I've had have taught me how to be of service today. And so that's really what I focus on. So I'll show you how I got into Al-Anon. This is a gay bar in Sacramento called The Rec Room. Great hunting grounds for a co-alcoholic. Yay. Yes, growing up in Sacramento, California, my mother was an alcoholic. And the disease of alcoholism is a progressive one. So it started out with just little things like she would be late coming home from work. As the single mother of five and me being the oldest, I sort of made sure that, things ran until she got home. And so, the time started to stretch out a little bit longer. First, it was stopping on the way home for a drink, and then it just kept getting progressively longer. I'll never forget the first time she did not come home at all. And I remember I woke up early and I got scared. And I remember my brothers and sisters woke up right after that and asked, "Where's mom?" And, just on a snap, I turned around and said, "Well, she had to get up early this morning and go to work, but she's fine." And I learned in that instant that I had to learn how to lie. I had to learn how to lie really well, and I had to learn how to lie really quickly so that others would be okay. Whether I was okay or not was immaterial, but so that others would be okay. And that was something that I would develop as equally and as fast as my mother's alcoholism developed. And so she eventually down the road cashed in her retirement after working with the state for a number of years and bought a bar. That was the family business. And so, yeah, I never saw my mother. And so, so, we were home alone a lot. And there was times when the police came to the door and asked, where is your parents, you know? And I always made up lies, and I was really good at it. And I'd do my little tap dance, and I always seemed to be convincing, and they always went away. And that's how I grew up. And so when I left home and became an adult, it wasn't surprising to me that I went down to the bar to find alcoholics. Because, you see, I was going through my own form of withdrawal. There's no other way to describe it. I was used to an insane environment, and I needed that. It was what I was used to. It's what I felt comfortable with. So let's just talk about my drug of choice right now. This gelatinous ooze in this test tube, that's adrenaline. Let's go to our first Al-Anon fact. Alcoholics are a great source of adrenaline. Oh, my God. And with some of the men that I met in that bar, it was like hitting the mother load. I mean, when I got adrenaline flowing through my body, I feel alive. I love you and I hate you all in the same instant. I want to live forever, and I sure hope God takes you in the next 2 minutes, because I feel all of that at once. I've got all this feeling going through my body. And those 2 a.m. fights that we used to have would just set it off. My day was made. And as crazy as that sounds, that I can think of no other way to convey to you the disease of co-alcoholism. I felt alive, and I lived for that. I realized, though, that I had a problem. This careening from crazy relationship to crazy relationship was definitely creating a problem. So I identified the problem that I had in my life. Back to the Capitol Dome. Sacramento was the problem. Sacramento was the problem because I'd run out of prospects in that bar, and I needed to go on and find some new prospects. And so I did the only thing that I can think of to do, because I didn't have much of an education and I didn't really have a job to speak of. So that's me in a Navy outfit. I joined the military. Which created, was this a pattern? Solving one problem, creating a whole new set of problems. And so, just like you saw from the cheerleading picture, you know, I'm somewhat effeminate. So this, I don't know if this was going to work out. But even in the Navy, you know, I found a solution. That's the color guard. That's me marching up and down the field with a flag. That's me twirling a rifle like it is the last baton on earth. So I got to be the cheerleader I always wanted to be in the Navy. Miracles happen. What also happened was I got to travel. I got to go to exciting places. So there's Orlando, Florida, Meridian, Mississippi, Detroit, Michigan. You know, join the Navy, see the world. And I was in Detroit, Michigan, of all places, where it's where I got stationed, the Naval Air Facility, Detroit. And I really thought it was a death sentence. I had no desire to go to Detroit. I didn't know what life was going to be like in the Midwest. It was obviously very different than it was in Sacramento, where I'm from. But what inevitably happened was that I started having problems. I started having problems because I really thought, and I honestly thought this, that if I could put space or distance between me and the alcoholics in my life, that I would be okay. And what I now know in retrospect, of course, is that no geographic cure is going to solve what we have. A spiritual solution really is the only solution that I've discovered that works. But at the time, I thought 2,400 miles, that's a pretty good distance. I'll be all right. But what was happening was that my mother's disease was really progressing at this point. Now she was having DTs. And my brothers and sisters who were still in school would call me up and say, you got to come home. And what I tried to explain to them was, you know, I'm in the Navy now, and I can't just say I need a break. It doesn't work that way. But inevitably, what happened was the Red Cross intervened and said, no, you really do have to go home. Your mother's very sick. And so I went home. And let me back up first and tell you how I got to my first meeting, because I had actually gone to my first meeting by this point. So in this church in Detroit, in this basement with these embroidered slogans, that's where I landed my very first meeting and thought, oh, no. No, 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 no. Someone's made a mistake. Because I'm like 19 years old or 20 years old, and I'm, you know, in my little Navy outfit. And I'm sitting with all these older women, and I'm thinking, I have nothing in common with these people. There can be no good reason for me to be here. But I'm going to hang out because obviously there's supposed to be some solution told here about how you get them sober. So I'm willing to sit it out for that. And the very first woman that shared the meeting that day, she said, you know, my name is so-and-so, and I'm a grateful recovering co-alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the 12 steps of the Al-Anon family groups, I have not found it necessary to plan the homicide of another human being for 4.5 years. That's a strand of pearls, which I was not wearing that night. But had I been, I would have been forced to clutch them because I could not believe she just said it. And thought, no, no, no. We have nothing in common. But I knew that they needed me because they told me to keep coming back. And I am not a co-alcoholic who does not go where I'm needed. So I went back the next night. And they said, you came back. Like they were surprised or something. And I said, yes. And they said, we are so glad you came back. And we want to offer you the position of chairman at this group. And I thought, oh my God, finally someone has recognized my true talents. What do I have to do? And they said, well, before the meeting, you take the chairs from over there and you put them around the tables. And then after the meeting, you take them from around the tables and you put them back over there. And I want to speak just a minute about service and what that has done for me in Al-Anon. What service does for me is it allows me to feel connected to a group in a way that nothing else really does. Because I can come to meetings and I can sit and I can hang out and I can listen to the person speak and then leave right after and never feel like it's my group. I can never feel a part of. What service has done for me is allowed me to take ownership of something in that meeting. And I have to tell you that I didn't know that that transformation was taking place, but after about 60 or 90 days or however long I did those chairs, when the next person came along to do it, I was like, you're doing it wrong. I mean, because I know how to do these chairs. They were lined up perfectly and everything was fine just when I was doing it. And I knew that the miracle had happened. Like that was now my home group. And I was a part of that group. And so this was all before November 3rd, 1984, which is my recovery date in Al-Anon. So I didn't claim the time before that because just before November 3rd, 1984 is when I had to go home. And I was having a huge Al-Anon slip because, see, I hadn't really worked the steps. I was just kind of hanging out in meetings. I had a sponsor. Maybe I'd call him. Maybe I wouldn't. You know, after that service commitment was over, maybe I'd get another one or maybe I wouldn't. And so I wasn't really doing the deal. And so because I had no recovery really underneath my belt, when I got that call that said you had to go home because your mother's really sick, I just jumped on the first plane and headed home because I just knew they needed me. And so I want to tell you that I've heard alcoholics speak in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous about how they got to that point where drinking just no longer worked. It just didn't work anymore. And because of the progressive nature of co-alcoholism, that's exactly where I was. My tools just didn't work. I tried everything. My mother had been holed up in her bedroom for about 2 weeks, and she was in bed, and she wouldn't come out because she was convinced she was dying. And so I went in there, and I tried everything to coax her to get up and rejoin life, you know. I used guilt. I used shame. I used embarrassment. We even got to the point where we played my favorite game, which is, guess what I'm mad about? We tried everything, and nothing. Nothing worked. And I went home dejected. I was really disappointed in myself mostly. But it was on the plane back to Detroit that I really grasped the concept of the first step. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. And so what I realized that day was that I was ready to really take on the program of Al-Anon and do the work that's required. And so I got off the plane. I went immediately to my home group, and I started the steps, which up to that point I'd been calling the pool rules, because I rolled my eyes whenever I saw them because I could not grasp a concept of God. I did not want to talk about. I equated it all to religion. I mean, my first very Catholic experiences growing up was fairly devout, and I did all the things that I was supposed to do as an altar boy and got confirmed and all that stuff. And then I remember going into that first bar at the rec room and seeing my priest there having a beer and thinking, You sat on the other side of that curtain from me and heard me tell you my tale of woe and how suicidal I was, and you never, ever, as a human being, reached out and said that I would be okay. Instead, you gave me an assignment. So the concept of having anything to do with religion, and because I couldn't yet separate spirituality from religion, I really wanted nothing to do with the program of Al-Anon. I was willing to come to your meetings, and I was willing to sit it out until you got to that part where you told us how we were going to get them sober, which never seemed to come. But I was not willing to do what was asked. But on November 3rd, 1984, I became willing in a way that I hadn't been willing before. And that's really when things began to change for me. And so I got the sponsor that I had, began to use, and things began to change. My outlook and attitude upon life had become different. And it wasn't easy, and my sponsor still talked in bumper stickers and riddles, and I didn't understand a lot of stuff, you know. And I would say things like, you know, I'm having a hard time with God, and he would say, that's because it hasn't occurred to you that God has had a hard time with you. And I didn't understand any of that stuff, and so I kept coming back. And it's about this point that I had my spiritual awakening. And what that looked like for me was really the clouds parting and the light shining down. And I know that most people's spiritual awakening is of the educational variety, and it happens over a long, slow period. But for me, I had gotten arrested in the Navy and charged with homosexuality. This is the part where you're supposed to gasp. Feign surprise, I know. It's like... It's like, there's the pearls. Had I been wearing that day, I would have been forced to grasp them because I couldn't believe they just arrested me. And so they took me to this room and, you know, made me raise my pant legs to show that I didn't shave my legs. And eventually, you know, take off my clothes to show I wasn't wearing women's underwear. And, you know, thank God that day I wasn't. And so I got legal representation, and my attorney said, well, what you need to do is you need to take a lie detector test. And I was like, wow, that's a great idea. Great. Because bring it on. Because I've been lying for a long time, and guess what? I'm pretty fucking good at it. Hook me up to this machine. I ain't scared of you. And as they sat in this room for about 6 hours waiting for this lie detector test, I got scared. I got scared on a level that I'd never been scared before, ever. I was shaking. I was so scared because I started that Al-Anon chess game. The Al-Anon chess game goes like this. First, they're going to say this, but I'm going to counter with this. But I'll be ready because they're going to then come back with this. But then I'll come at them with this. And it goes back and forth, and it just, my mind would not shut up. If you've ever sat at home waiting at 3 a.m. for an alcoholic to come home or wonder where they're at, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I was insane. And I want to tell you that day, I saw the pool rules differently. I saw the third step said, as we understood him. And in that moment, I realized that meant what my sponsor had been saying for weeks and weeks, which is that I could have any kind of God I wanted. That I could build my own God, and it could be anything that I could imagine. And what I could imagine was that I would have a God that was personal to me, would be my best friend, that would never pass judgment on me, that would be with me all the time. And the thought of never having to be alone ever again blew my mind. It blew it wide open because I had been lonely my entire life up until that day when I realized I really didn't have to feel that way anymore. And my life changed from that moment. And so I got into service in a way that I hadn't before. I started sponsoring people in the way that I hadn't before, and my life changed. I got orders to San Jose, California, and so I moved to San Jose. I stayed in the Navy. I made it through that incident with the arrest, and so I was in for like 12 years. So I'm in San Jose, California, and I'm still dating active using alcoholics, and I'm like, something's not right. You know, he just tried to run me over with the car yesterday, and here we are having dinner, and I got to get to a meeting after this. And, you know, my life is not supposed to look like this. But I couldn't stop myself. And so my sponsor said, you know, have you thought about dating anybody in that room across the way? And I was like, the AA meeting? Isn't that like shopping in the irregular section? I mean... It's like a big scratch and dent sale over there. I'm not going over there. And he said, if you haven't been paying attention to your track record, that's who you're dating now. Except those people over there at least admitted and trying to do something about it. And I thought, oh, okay. And so I asked, went out. He had, you know, like 90 days. Or he had almost 90 days. And in my Al-Anon home group gasped, you know. And but, you know, I'd been chasing wet ones for so long, I was just happy to get a damp one. And so... Y'all talk about progress, not perfection. I thought clearly this is progress, and so, but you know what I was met with was a lot of judgment. There was a lot of people that had judgment about it, and thank God my sponsor was a double winner, and you know he brought out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and opened it up to page 68 and 69, and you know paraphrasing what it talks about is that you know God alone can judge our sex situation, that you know advice from others is neither wanted or needed. And so what he said is that there's going to be a lot of people that will pass judgment. And the truth is that, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous or in Al-Anon, you can find lots of advice givers. You know, there's people who will tell you how to have a successful relationship as they're going to divorce court for the eighth time. There's people who will tell you how to manage your finances who are currently in bankruptcy. I mean, there's just lots of advice givers. And what he suggested to me was that I stay away from them. That what we do is we show people how to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. We don't tell them how to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I really got that, I think. And I have to tell you that, you know, that 23 years later, he and I are still together. And so, yes, they are like dog years, so that's a long time. Ooh, Lordy. Having two programs in one house has had its challenges, but it's been wonderful. We've been able to recover together, and we have our sets of sponsees that we corral around, and life is really good. I'm going to tell you, jump to what it's like now. So it's another dome, but this one is in Texas. And so I move from one capital to the next. Texas has been amazing for me. What happened was I went to the Austin Roundup about 5 years ago and fell in love. Thought I had died and gone to Texas. I thought, this is the greatest kept secret in the world. And so I went home and I said, honey, we're moving to Texas. And he was like, oh, for my dead body. But when we'd been living in San Jose and I suggested we move to Sacramento, he said the same thing, so I knew it carried no weight. And so, I mean, you know. Defiance is an outstanding characteristic of an alcoholic, and that's what I get for marrying an alcoholic. But, you know, we're in Texas. So that's what you get for marrying a co-alcoholic. And so I'm in Texas now, and life is really different. They do recovery very different. The communication style is much more direct, which I wasn't used to. I'm from Northern California, where it's very warm and fuzzy, fruits and nuts, and it's not that in Texas. But I've adapted, and it's been fascinating for my program and for my spiritual growth to learn a new way of living, even inside of learning a new way of living. And it's been amazing. I want to share with you the progress that I've made with my family in our relationship. My mother no longer drinks. She went to AA for a while, and then she took a different spiritual path, which is, I suppose, fine, because AA claims that they don't have the answer for everybody. But she's not drinking, and I'm happy about that. But we were on a journey through Central California, and so she, about 50 miles into the trip, said she had something to tell me, but she started crying. She said, but I can't tell you now. And then, I know, I hate that. And then about 100 miles into the trip, she said, okay, I think I'm ready to tell you. No, I'm not ready to tell you now. About 150 miles into the trip, she said, okay, there's this thing called an amends. And she says, from my work, I know I owe you one. And she said, and I hadn't known how I was going to approach this conversation. She said, but what I need to tell you is that I know that I was an absent mother. And I know that it was really hard on you because you raised your brother and sister. And I know that I robbed you of a childhood. And she said, and I don't know how you atone for something like that. So what I need to ask you is, how can a person make restitution for that? And I want to tell you that I had both hands on the wheel, and I was looking straight ahead, and I started to tear up. But as soon as those tears came up, they went back, and I couldn't understand my reaction. Because, you see, I had had that conversation with her 100 times. 100 times. I mean, all the time I was growing up, we'd had that conversation over and over again. And in every instance, you know, I'd exhaled on my cigarette, and I don't even smoke. I'd be like, And then my best Betty Davis would be, God damn right, you're sorry. But from the time that I'd rehearsed it to the time that it actually happened, miracles happen. And certainly the miracle that is Al-Anon happened for me. Because what I realized in that moment, I turned to her and I said, it's okay, Mom. It's all right. What surprised me about the interchange really was mostly that I meant it, that it was okay. And that's what really blew me away. Because I realized in that moment that because of my alcoholic upbringing, because of the things that I had experienced in my life, I am a product of everything that I have been through. And I like who I am today. And the things that I have experienced allow me to relate to other people in the program of Al-Anon. And that's been a miracle in my life. If I'd had the perfect life, I wouldn't have needed Al-Anon. I wouldn't have needed God. And I probably wouldn't have even needed you. And you've been the biggest gift to me. And I wouldn't be here at this conference. And I wouldn't have met all of you. And I wouldn't give that up for anything. And so when I think about some of the drama and the trauma, sure, it's not a bowl of cherries, but it's not the end of the world. And it's that concept of this too shall pass that has allowed me to keep moving forward in my recovery, even when things get real. And so, and they have at times gotten real. And so I'll share with you that, you know, on my about almost 3 years ago, my husband called me on my Al-Anon birthday of all times. And I looked at the phone and I saw he was calling. And I thought, finally, it only took 25 years, but finally he remembered it, my day. And so I thought, how sweet of him to call me on my Al-Anon anniversary. So I picked up the phone and he said, can you come home? We need to talk. And I said, okay. So I left work and I went home. And he told me that he was trading in his 21-year chip for a 24-hour one. And I didn't see it coming. And a lot of things went through my mind. And a lot of things went through my heart. And what I asked him if he was okay. I asked him if he was going to be okay. I asked him if he was connected to his sponsor. I asked him if he was you know, going to go to a meeting. And when he responded affirmative to all that, I said, okay, then I'm leaving. I'm going to go to an Al-Anon meeting. And I think he was a little bit shocked by my response. Like, I don't know what he expected, but that's about the extent of I'm a human power. I forget that sometimes, but I'm a human power. And I can't relieve anybody's alcoholism. And so I went to my Al-Anon meeting and I cried. I cried mostly for the loss of what I thought I had. See, because I thought we were like some power couple in AA or Al-Anon, if that's possible. Like, here we are, you know, together for all these years, recovered for all these years. You know, all these people, you know, come into our house day and night, you know, seeking suggestion on how to stay together or how to get sober or how to recover in Al-Anon or what to do. And I had this image of what my life was, and it was all blown away that day. And that's really all I'm going to say about it. Because in Al-Anon, we have tradition about, you know, taking extra care to protect the anonymity of members of AA. So that's really... He has his own story. And if he ever is invited to talk from a podium that you get to hear, you'll hear it. But this is my story. So what I got that day was that I was going to be okay because I had a God of my understanding who would help me through that. And that the partnership that I enjoy with my husband is a wondrous thing. It really is. But we have a hierarchy in our home. And it's really God, recovery, relationship. And the times that I've gotten into trouble is when I've tried to rearrange that order. Because without God, without recovery, there is no relationship. None. And so on that day, maybe it was his intent that the relationship move up to the top. I don't know. I just knew that I had to get right back to that hierarchy right away. And because I did that, I think I survived that event to the best of my ability with as much dignity and grace as I was able to. The 12 steps in Al-Anon have been an amazing experience. If you hadn't had a chance to work them, please do. There's nothing to be fearful of. There's nothing in a fourth step that, or fifth step that you can share that hasn't already been heard. I did my first fifth step. I have to say this. I was talking to my first original Al-Anon sponsor this morning, saying I'm going up there to do it again. And he's like, it seems like a lifetime ago, 27 years ago. He goes, do you remember your first fifth step? And I said, of course I remember. We were on our way to Toronto from Detroit in his little Honda CRX, which was new at the time, the little teeny tiny car. And because Toronto had asked me to speak for the very first time as an Al-Anon speaker in 1987, Toronto Gratitude. And I called him and I said, oh my gosh, I've got asked to be an Al-Anon speaker. And he goes, oh, that's wonderful. He goes, that's so sad that you have to call them and tell them you can't do it. And I was like, what? And he goes, well, yeah, you haven't finished your stuff, so what the hell are you going to talk about? And I was like, ugh. He goes, make you a deal. You do your fifth step before you get up to the podium, and you can talk at least up to that point. And I said, all right. So on the way to Toronto Gratitude 87, I'm telling my fifth step. And there wasn't anything on that list that he hadn't heard. There wasn't anything on that list that, you know, we didn't cry about together and get over. There wasn't anything on that list that I regret telling another human being. So if you haven't had the chance to work the steps, please know, you know, that that's really where the miracle happens. It's in the steps. And so wrapping up, I want to go to one last slide, or several slides. You'll notice this as the Miracles Happen banner logo from 1988. And there's 89 and 90 and so on. You know, what you all are doing here, what we are doing here, is creating a legacy. And I've heard a lot about it this weekend. I've met people who have been here since the beginning. Becoming an old-timer in Al-Anon, if there's such a thing, has been an amazing experience because I'm now sponsoring people who haven't, you know, been on Earth as long as I've been in the program. It trips me out. Only when they remind me about it. I tolerate them with all my heart. But what it's created for me is the opportunity to really see my life as a continuum and to see the program of Al-Anon as a continuum and to know that there's people that preceded me that I never got a chance to meet, but that I'm here because of them. There's people who had to set this up originally. There's people who had to keep it going when there's no one around who wanted to had the energy or the gumption to keep it going. And of course, there's the participants that keep coming year after year after year, whether they want to or not. I've learned in Al-Anon that willingness and wanting to are not the same thing. And I just need to do it. And so things like this conference don't just happen. It takes a lot of people who are committed to service and committed to keep coming back over and over and over again. And that really is ultimately how the miracle happens. And so what I want to thank the committee for is inviting me here, but also for having that commitment to keeping miracles happen year after year. And I hope you have another 25 years. Thanks for having me.